Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
Happy Throwback Thursday, everybody.
Huzzah.
Huzzah. That's so wonderful, Kevin. I love that. Once again, so excited. I'm excited because we have a very special guest with us today.
Yes, we do, Rob.
The brilliant, the wonderful, incredibly talented Tony Award-winning costume designer, Paloma Young, is with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Hi, Paloma.
How are you?
I'm great.
Thank you for joining us today.
It's beautiful and sunny outside, finally. Even though there's snow everywhere.
Yeah. Thank you for trudging through the snow in the beautiful day to get to us.
I've got good boots.
I would hope as a costume designer you would have good boots. So, Paloma, just a couple of questions for you before we begin all of this fun stuff. Where were you born?
I was born in Southern California, just outside of San Diego.
I was born in Southern California, too. Ventura County area?
I was born in Poway.
Oh, nice.
At a military hospital.
Mom and dad or
My grandparents.
Grandparents. That's very cool. That's very cool. Did you do your training in California as well? You're studying?
I did. I went to University of California, Berkeley for my undergrad, and I did not specifically study costume design there, but I was a history major, and I dabbled in the theater department when I was there, and then when it came time to doing my graduate work, I found myself back home in San Diego at UC San Diego.
And graduate work in?
In costume design.
In costume design. When you were studying history, mm-hmm. were you studying a specific period that you were more attracted to?
Well, I started out doing Holocaust studies.
Uh-huh.
Interesting.
Which was actually, I was an undergrad and I came more or less straight out of high school. And so, I was 18, 19 years old, and I found it actually just emotionally exhausting.
Yeah.
In a way that I was like, this is really interesting subject matter, and I'm feeling it a little too deeply to be an academic about it. And so I switched my focus to what was referred to at the time as social history, which is kind of, it's like social anthropology. You're looking at things that regular people do as opposed to politicians and rulers and wars and that sort of thing.
Cultures and stuff.
All history is related, but sort of my thesis was about the development of the concept of the co-ed in American university life.
Oh, fascinating.
Oh, that's really fascinating.
So, I mean, it was just through media and then sort of like there was co-education all the way back in the 19th century. It became much more common as you get into the 20th century, but it wasn't until the 20s because of, I won't give you my whole thesis here, but
it's good.
It was just sort of, you know, when we think of a co-ed, it's definitely a woman. It's maybe kind of a ditzy woman. She's pretty. She's sassy. Maybe she's a cheerleader. Like, there are definitely, like, ideas about her that, I think mostly we interact with through Playboy does an annual issue, I think, the co-ed issue. Or just it's become a word in our lexicon, but that didn't really exist until the 20s, and which was this kind of way in the media to deal with a new kind of woman that was independent and yeah. So it was just sort of like looking at the ways that visually they were depicted in media. What did the cartoons look like versus what did photographs of real female college students look like?
How fascinating.
Yeah. Did you have a lot of immersion in theater in high school growing up?
Very little. I would say my father would take me to touring musicals. I think I saw all of the Andrew Lloyd Webber greatest hits.
Yes, of course. Classic.
We would drive up to LA, or sometimes we would come down to San Diego. So I saw those productions. But as far as being active in theater, I was much more in the arty group. Like was, you know, take photography and art.
Were you a drawer? I mean, growing up, did you?
It's like a painter, just like a dabbler, like collage.
Okay.
I'm not that good at drawing.
Okay.
That's just like, because that's sort of like, I think that there's this misconception that all costume designers make these beautiful renderings, and some of them do, and some of them hire other people to do them.
Didn't know that.
I've hired illustrators at times just because I don't have time.
Yeah.
But it's also a lot of the great vendors that I work with that make these like beautiful costumes for me. They're able to translate from a really crappy drawing and a couple pieces of research. Like, we can talk through it and they like
and get the vision.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Wild.
So yeah. So I was more of an art student. I did have one moment. I ran away to Berlin when I was in high school.
Oh, wow.
I mean,
when you say run away to Berlin.
My parents didn't know where I was.
Okay.
So
full on running away to Berlin.
Yeah. I had a little money saved up for a car, and instead I was like, I can't be in rural San Diego anymore. And so I had a distant cousin who was more my mother's age, but I had run into her in a family function, and she lives in Berlin and was like, you can come stay with us anytime. And so I came and stayed in her attic.
Wow.
And eventually signed up to go to school there because I was lonely. And I was like, oh, actually, the only thing I'm good at is school.
How old were you when you did this adventure?
16.
Okay, perfect.
Wow.
Do you speak German?
I mean, I'm much better at eavesdropping in German. and I can definitely get by if I needed key information. However, the Germans all learn English in school.
Oh,
and
of course they do.
And a large majority of them retain it because it is a global language. And also they love speaking it, unlike the French. So the minute that you try and speak to this, you know, it's a blanket statement. I'm sure there are plenty of Germans that hate speaking English. But my experience was I would try and speak German to someone. They would hear my American accent, and they would immediately reply to me in English that was far superior to my German. So it was just, I didn't have the incentive to continue to attempt to speak really shitty German. I went there. I went to school. While I was in school, I wanted to be in the art class, and they said the art class was full, but I could join the drama class. So that is the only. It was an acting class. It's the only acting class I've ever taken, and we were doing a production of "You Can't Take It With You," I was cast as Mrs. Kirby, who is like the sort of uppity rich mother.
Nice.
And I was very bad at it, I'm sure. there's luckily no record of it. But one of the things that I did do while I was there is the sort of basement storage had been flooded, and I was much more interested in organizing all of the costume stock than actually being in the play.
Sure, sure.
And so I'm very glad to have had the experience, because I have a great respect for all of the actors that I work with, and understand why they're so crazy.
Sure.
So that's sort of my only contact with theater in high school, was that very, I think, different than most American high school students.
Sure.
With like what you would call like a drama kid.
Yes. Yes, totally.
And then why did you decide to go to graduate school?
So I had done a little bit of costume design in undergrad, just sort of took a couple classes that were available at Berkeley. They're not really a design or production-oriented school. They're much more theoretical. They don't have a graduate department in design in their theater department. And what that meant for me as just like, hey, I'm a history major, but I like this class, and I was... a Gold Star student, and they said, hey, do you want to like design this like a Beckett shorts? And I was like, sure. I think in a lot of these more theater oriented schools, you have kids that have been doing theater since they were born, or high school or whatever, and the field of competition is much higher. So there's not much room for someone that's like, sure, I'll try that out.
Yeah.
Like, and so I don't know that I would have ended up here at all if I hadn't just been in this thing where I was like, this is fun. And sure, I'll try that.
Yeah.
So I did that, and then I designed a couple more things at Berkeley while I was a student and shortly after I graduated. And then I sort of went off to be like, what am I going to do with my life as a bartender and SAT tutor? And I was a fact checker for history books, and was just like, am I going to be a librarian? And I just sort of had this like epiphany of like, I really miss this thing that I was just doing for fun. And maybe I can do that for my life, but I'm not trained enough because I wasn't focused on it as a career.
Right, right.
And I think I didn't really have anyone to talk to, because I think if I had talked to anyone, they would have told me that I needed to do work in the field.
Right.
But I didn't. I just went to school because that is what I saw as like the option on the table that I understood how to do it.
Right. And you like education, and it seems. And
yeah.
So it made sense that you would go to graduate school for that.
So I just applied to graduate school, and then I ended up down in San Diego.
Yeah.
And then I started paying attention to it.
Like, right, and
a
really
lot
studying
more
it.
In
and
theater,
yes,
yes,
of course.
When you went to graduate school, did you think that upon graduation you would immediately become a working designer, or did you think that you might go and teach somewhere?
I had no idea.
You just wanted.
I think I went through that not focused on career, or just was sort of, I will see where this leads me. And I thought, I guess if you had asked me maybe a year before graduating, I thought maybe I'll be doing some shows for no money and then being a waitress or being a bartender again or a tutor. I love teaching, and I haven't taught in years, and I miss it a lot. And I did end up teaching at UCSD after I graduated for a couple of years.
Yeah.
So, but it wasn't like, it sort of got proposed to me, and then we sort of worked out a curriculum around it.
We have a lot of listeners who are in the middle of their graduate school training. If there's one piece of advice that you could give them while they are still in school, what might it be?
Keep track of your research. Just as a designer, I find that I remember vaguely. You collect so much interesting information, the names of artists, the names of obscure, European films from the 60s, and all of this stuff gets thrown at you. And I'm a very messy person, and I especially was in grad school. I'm kind of become more organized in my 30s, but I mean, it was literally just a lot of Xeroxes everywhere, and things would get crumpled, and then I'd throw them away.
Literally of ideas or things that you love.
Even like things that a teacher shared with us, and I was like, now I'm trying to remember those, and then I can't find them.
Yeah.
For the most part, it's like I just can't even access the information. Like, what was the name of that movie? I remember seeing this movie that had, like, this weird minotaur in it, but it wasn't this movie, and it wasn't that movie. Yeah. So, and also a lot of the research that I found myself, I wasn't very good at preserving it. Mm. And so even if you just, and I think that a lot of students now, a lot of their information and visuals are all coming through digital media. And so it just like make that folder and like don't have like a junk folder.
Right.
Like, like be like this, what, you know, this is As You Like It 2017, make that folder. Make it easy to search, even if all of your files have like gobbledygook names on them.
Right.
Like, have it in a single place where you can find it later.
How much, I think a lot of people don't realize how much work goes into the research before you get a project. You spend, I would love to know how much time, assembling visions, magazine clips, multimedia stuff. I mean, we went to William Ivy Long's studio and the whole room was full of research. I think a lot of people don't realize that there's so much work that you do before you put your pen on the paper and say, this is what it's going to look like for this show.
Well, yeah, I think at least what I do as a designer is I'm creating clothes for characters to tell a story. Mm-hmm. Whether those and sometimes you're creating clothes on performers or dancers that are almost more like scenic, like creating,
sure,
Busby Berkeley Girls or that sort of thing. But for the most part, I do work where I'm creating characters or part of the creation of characters. And even if those characters exist, 200 years ago, or in a fantasy world that's made up of, it's sci-fi, but it's also a little bit Old West, or, when you get dressed in the morning, like, did you make your clothes from scratch?
Right.
No, like, none of us did. And if you did in 2017, that says a lot about who you are as a person. Like, you are a very weird person.
Yeah.
And I want to know that person. But also just, I think that it's very important to understand the concept. So if you give me a character like Natasha in Great Comet that just opened, like, she's a fictional character that, was written by Dave Malloy, coming out of Tolstoy wrote her first, and then Dave interpreted her for the musical. But she's a person. She's written as a person.
Yes.
And in a specific time period. And even though it gets filtered through so much research, whether that's visual or musical or historical, at its core, I think it needs to be real clothes, or it has to be at least moored there. Because if I just drew the actress on the page and then fantasized about what a dress would look like without any sort of, like, what did people really wear as dresses, yeah, in 1812, like of different classes, of different regions in the world. So yeah, I'm looking at details like Russia, embroidery, yeah, versus, yeah, you know, Russia versus France, yeah, and that sort of thing. And I don't have to use that, but I want to have those things to draw from. And even then, also then I go look at magazines because I'm like, this photo shoot from, you know, 2016 looks like these two models remind me of the relationship between Sonia and Natasha. And so, oh, fascinating, like the way that a contemporary audience is looking at relationships and character through our contemporary visual language. So it's important to stay current,
yes,
into like what our visual language is right now.
Yeah.
And also to have that history and just like literally have thousands of pictures in front of me when I go to draw that dress, as opposed to just like coming up with it out of thin, yeah, air.
Right. You have to have inspiration. And just side note, did you intend for her to look like a comet? I mean, like when I saw a picture of her, and it was the first time we saw the show, yes, loved it, and I watched this video on Broadway World of you talking about, and there was a photo of her, and it was like the whole show came into view for me because of that costume, because I thought, oh my God, she's like the comet to him. And I don't know if that was intended, but it really kind of rocked me a little bit because she does shine in it like a comet. And I don't know if that was intended or if that just was a happy accident.
I didn't come to the table specifically being like Natasha is the comet.
Yeah.
But I did want there to be visual connection, albeit very subtle, I think, totally, for most observers, between Natasha and the atmosphere that Mimi Lian, the, mm-hmm, set designer, had created, and also just the language of movement in that show.
Yeah.
So Pierre is located right in the center of everything, and in an area, there's all of the areas on stage, because there's so many, yeah, as they go into the house, that is sort of unceremoniously called the donut.
yeah, but that loop with the band right there in the center.
But he's basically, yeah, sits in a circular pit, and a lot of the key action happens around him in a kind of orbit. And it's even like not quite a circle; it's an oval, which is the orbit of comets. You'd have to ask Mimi if that was intentional, but it was something, wow, that I noticed. But there's the language of the show, you know, musically, scenically, choreographically, is very circular. Mm. It's a lot of round corners. It's a lot of sort of spiraling. Spiraling out of control, spiraling into each other, and then you have all of these chandeliers that are that kind of mid-century Sputnik, like they're globes, but then they have sort of offshooting, mm-hmm, little rays,
yes,
and then those rays have more globes of light on them. And so when you look at Natasha, all of her, we have a lot of laces in the show and things you would expect to be in, you know, at the opera, at a, right, ball in 19th century Russia. Mm-hmm. But Natasha's motifs are all circular. And so she's got these kind of glittery silver polka dots on her, mm-hmm, ball dress. And then she has these a beaded fringe that is a silver echo of the rays that are coming out of the chandeliers. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's a long silver bead, and then at the end is we have these spherical beads. I'm like, okay, yeah, can I access my words to that?
No, yeah.
Yeah, no, so we have these. So yes, it was totally intentional that, like, she has these relationships to what the, you know, the chandeliers ultimately become to represent the comet as well.
Yeah.
And so, and she also has this, like, double ring gold headband, which is, it's period, or it relates to a period hairstyle, but it is also, like, like all of our orbits around yes. Pierre.
And has that edgy quality as well. And yeah.
When you first got this show, what is, or on any show specifically, or not specifically, I should say, your conversations, where do your conversations begin? I'm assuming the first conversation is between you and the text to figure out what the text is saying and where the text wants to go. What's your next conversation in your collaborative world?
Well, I'll usually read the text, and if it's a musical, I try and get my hands on some form of the music, whether it's a demo or... So sometimes it's been worked on previously, so some bit of the music, get the text, read it through, and then read it through again, taking notes, not notes like it's raining here but notes of like, this seems like this guy's an asshole, sometimes it'll just be about like place or language or, So I take a few notes. It's usually I write on the front page of the script.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Because it's always easy to find those initial notes. And then I meet with the director.
And very quickly, do you like to have any input from the director prior to your first read? Or do you like to go in with a clean slate?
I don't mind it. Sometimes a director has really strong ideas that are like, I want you to think about this while you're reading the script. Mm-hmm. And so I that happens very rarely, but mm-hmm. I'm not going to push them away.
What's your ideal designer-director relationship or collaboration?
My ideal relationship is that I have a director that trusts me, because a director is very busy. And I want to feel like the director, that I've understood the director and what their vision is, and that I've communicated that enough with them that they feel comfortable that I'm going to execute it. Because whatever is on the page, whatever is on the research, it's always different when it's on a human being, when it's on stage.
Yeah.
And so I don't want to have to constantly be barraging a director with minutiae that I'm dealing with, because I want to feel like in the end what I put up on stage is going to be 95% what they were hoping for.
Right.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Do you like to be in a lot of the rehearsals, or do you like to go off, do your own thing?
I would love to be in a lot of the rehearsals. I'm usually too busy.
Yeah.
So I will come for run throughs. One of the things is I really depend on the actors as translators and messengers. So whenever they come into their fittings, I will ask them how rehearsals are going. I'll get a sense of whether everyone in the room is exhausted or excited or both. And then as I'm putting the clothes on them, I'll have them move around in the ways that they've been moving. I will try and sense if there's hesitation about anything about their costume.
You like feedback from actors about...
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the actor is... in a lot of ways doing the same thing that a designer is doing. They read the script before rehearsal starts. They start thinking about they're maybe not necessarily doing so much visual research, but just like trying to define who this character is outside of just a few words that are on the page. Mm-hmm. And if they've come up with a very different idea than what I've come up with as a designer, it's going to be a train wreck on stage.
Yeah.
Because that actor is going to be working and creating a character that is totally wrong for the clothes. And so even though I might have discussed with the director beforehand, like, this is what we think this character is going to be, as soon as I sort of sense one of those large divergences, is like, I will contact the director about that.
Wow.
And just not like, this is a problem, we must fix it, but just like, how has this character changed now that you have been sitting in rehearsal with this actor? It seems like maybe our ideas are shifting.
Wow.
However, if you still feel very strongly about what we talked about before you started rehearsing with this actor, I think you need to talk to this actor because and give them, you know, push them in that direction or give them notes in that direction. So that's sort of like the one time that I will really engage with the director during the rehearsal process, is when I feel like relationship-wise, like or just idea-wise, an actor and I are in wildly different mm-hmm. places. But for the most part, I feel like the actor is in the room every day as the show is organically changing. And then they come to rehearsal, and I learn new things about it, and mm-hmm. I'm able to adjust.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you going to ask something? I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I'm curious. You know, we all know that Natasha Pierce started at Ars Nova in a very more intimate, shall we say, setting, in mm-hmm. which they beautifully, and you have beautifully done for the Imperial Theater, which is, let's say, a bigger space. How did your work translate to that? Did you have to make any adjustments at all? Well, now that you knew an audience was going to be viewing it, maybe not as close as we are sitting right now, but from half a football field away in some cases.
Well, in this particular case, there were only really a few major adjustments that had to get made. And by major, I mean just like, we're going to make this coat green instead of burgundy.
Ah.
Just because it disappears.
Yeah, sure.
In a larger space. But a lot of the initial ideas just happened to translate really well. You know, having our key character, Natasha, in white, in the middle of a room that is very, it's like red velvet walls mm-hmm. and it's sort of golden, warm brown flooring. And she really pops.
Oh yeah.
And so even though the dress itself is simple, like, that's actually quite important and has been important from the beginning. And then it's like, well, we don't want to make it like much more complex or add pattern to it. It's like, actually, it already sort of was perfect. And so a lot of those ideas, we just had the opportunity to make some of our items a little bit more luxe, but it was always something that was really like in there already.
That's amazing.
We punched the color of the ensemble a little bit more, but they still exist as a bridge between the audience and our principals.
Yeah, and love that effect.
And so, like, we couldn't. I wasn't interested in designing them from scratch to be built by a shop. They still need to be pieced together by real clothes that any person in our audience could go and find on the street.
Fantastic.
Wow.
That's so wonderful.
I mean, they aren't necessarily going to do that. Like, they're very stylized.
But the illusion of that, though, is clear. And it really did. That effect was really well done. I mean, it really really felt that.
Truly. How closely did you work with your set designer on Natasha Pierre in terms of making sure that the color scheme was appropriate, making sure texture was appropriate?
I mean, the thing about that set is it's a room, and it's a very complex room, and getting all of those angles and staircases to all meet up is a I don't know how Mimi does it, but it's sort of existed already. It's made of very few elements. And those elements have existed since Ars Nova. There was a moment, there have been a couple moments in the evolution of the show when we were looking at other Broadway theaters, or when we weren't looking at Broadway, but it was just sort of, looking to incorporate the set with the environment around it. And I remember Mimi was looking at some theater. I don't know what it was, but it was, it had a lot of sort of rich greens and kind of taupey marble in it. And she had sort of reimagined the set in that color scheme. So instead of the red velvet walls and, you know, she'd done the model and put it all in the space and all the designers were in there. And it was like, I see, I understand why you're doing this. But it was like, I think that is the wrong idea.
Another direction, yeah.
Yeah, well, but it was just because it was like that. The set, it was like the set is going to be the set the whole show,
right.
And there's something about for me, and that, and then I was sort of speaking just as an audience member and not as a fellow collaborator, but was when you go through these bunkers and then you step into the theater, and the theater is like, a warm, luxurious womb.
Yeah,
like it. There's something about the warmth of the space and the red specifically that is feels so luxurious and feels so specifically Russian. Even though I knew that Mimi was working off of, you know, these Russian palaces when she was looking at the sort of green and marble set, and then selfishly I was like, well, the white dress is gonna suck if you're just got this. It's like white on beige. It was more like the set already existed, and I worked off of that. And then as the set evolved, I sort of offered my feedback. The color of the floor has changed over time, but not in any sort of drastic way. So we go back and forth about, like, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? But in this particular instance, for Great Comet, it's like the set was the set, and then the set was an inspiration to me to work within.
Oh, that's...
What drew you to the Great Comet in the first place? Why did you decide to say yes to this job?
Because they offered it to me?
Yes.
No, I actually, like, this is not something we're sort of... You were asking about before we started the interview, but as far as my path as a designer, I was based out in California, and I had done I had worked at a couple high profile regional theaters, but then that seemed to sort of stagnate, and felt like I needed to make a move for my career. Either, you know, was I going to move up to LA and try and break into film and TV, or was I going to go out to New York and become a quote unquote New York designer? And so I moved to New York, and, you know, everyone had given me this impression that what you do is you take these jobs that pay $0 with a $500 budget, and that's how you meet your future collaborators, which are, you know, the director of this show is the AD on, you know, Jersey Boys, and then he's going to get through that. Like, so it all made sense to me as a structure. I had a really hard time getting any of those jobs because I had no connections through grad school on the East Coast, either through Yale or NYU. I just having the knowing about them to begin with, or being asked to interview for them, those opportunities were few and far between. And then when I did get those opportunities to interview, I didn't get the jobs because I didn't have New York experience. And so what happened is I had gotten one show in New York through a playwright that I had worked with in grad school. They were producing her play at Second Stage Uptown, and she introduced me to the director, and the director liked me enough to, you know, give the playwright the designer that she wanted.
Right. Take this risk on this.
So that was my first show in New York, and went fine. So at that point.
And when was that, if you don't mind?
Let me try and remember. I think that would have been, I moved to New York in 2008, and I think that might have been in 2010.
Okay, cool.
You know, I assisted a little for other people, and then I had day jobs that had nothing to do with theater. But that was my first design job in New York, and then even then, after that, people were like, "That's not enough New York experience." So you did this one show at Second Stage Uptown.
New York.
And then one of the shows that I had been attached to through my graduate school at UCSD, UCSD has a sister relationship with La Jolla Playhouse, and I had done some work at La Jolla for their workshops and their Page to Stage program, and they had brought me in to do Peter and the Starcatcher when it was a workshop production out there.
As a designer?
Yeah, as a designer, but as a local designer.
Mm. Sure.
Yeah,
so
I
you got to go back. Yeah.
I stayed with my mom.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, you know, I was like, yeah, I'm
good
local.
Good decision,
yeah,
Paloma.
Yeah, so it was like I was just about to move to New York. Like, I had my ticket and everything, but it was sort of like, oh, are you still local? And I was like, absolutely.
So you didn't feel like it was like a step back or anything like
no,
that?
No, I did the interview and, you know, read the script and loved the play. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so this would have been back in 2008 when that was sort of brewing. And I got that job, but then moved to New York and then flew back, had to fly back and be a quote unquote local designer. So that had been happening. And then eventually that show moved to New York Theater Workshop, and they brought me with the show.
Good.
And then it went to Broadway.
Yep.
And then after that.
And then there's the Tony Award.
And then I went to Tony Award. And then
yes.
After that, I got asked to interview for this little show at Ars Nova.
And you were like, oh, sure, like a little
no,
show
but it,
after
but
this.
But like, these were the things. I was like, no, I read the libretto, and I thought it sounded really interesting. I was also totally exhausted because they did reach out to me right in the middle of award season.
Sure.
I think at that point I had been nominated, but the Tonys hadn't happened yet. But, you know, I was just thrilled. I was like, yes, please. Like, this is what I have been waiting for, is to work at these really amazing off Broadway theaters that are doing edgy work.
So you're attracted to that kind of work, let's say.
I was. And I was like, oh, I finally have an in. I just had to get a Broadway show first. And then I have this story where I guess nobody noticed, but I was so tired. I went into this interview, I had my portfolio. Rachel Chavkin, the director, was talking about how she thought it was important that the principal characters be dressed in period clothes because the music itself was so not period. The set was sort of had period references but was a little bit more abstract. And I kept saying, oh, no, I get it. That's great. I've never done 1912, but and I just like my brain while I was on the subway had just like decided that this show took place in the early 20th century, even though I know I was a history major. I know War and Peace takes place
right
in the early 19th century, but at the same time I was showing her pictures of like Jane Austen stuff that I had designed. So
oh
I actually had designed in the correct period, but I was like, I've never personally designed wartime clothes before. I like left that interview and realized what I had done, and I was like, well, I'm never getting
You're like
that
horrified.
Job.
Yeah, oh my God.
That's what I get for like getting 2 hours sleep. But
oh my gosh!
But yeah, no. But they
booked it.
But they booked it. Yeah. But you know, and then I had the right. I then I knew it was 1812.
Exactly.
And we were off to a great start.
It was in the title. Amazing. Yeah, it's good though. It's in the title. No, it's all right. That's
so,
what they.
So you can. I've had amazing interviews where I was like, they love me. I have this job. Everything's great. And then they're like, a week later, they're like, we went with someone else. And
oh
like,
yeah.
You know, so it was like.
But the one you think you bomb is the one
like,
you book.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
That's classic.
So it was like I was interested in the job because they offered it, and also I do like work that is especially musical theater that is trying to do new and interesting things that I think maybe speak to audiences that didn't grow up going to the theater.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Indeed.
That is so awesome.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little about your next project, which I got to see at Paper Mill and thought it was fantastic, and that's Bandstand.
Yeah. Very excited. I'm very excited it's called Bandstand and not The Bandstand.
Yes.
Just Bandstand. Just,
even though I have no idea why. I'm not privy to these.
These decisions.
Two shows in one season.
Yeah, two shows in one season.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big year for me.
It's good.
And what period does Bandstand take place in?
It takes place right after we win World War II.
And
so it's like late 40s, mm-hmm. and it takes place over a very short period of time. Probably it's not specifically laid out, but it's about like a 6-month period. I could be wrong about that, so don't quote. But it's very short, less than a year.
Yes.
But one of the things that we're doing stylistically is we're playing around with pushing the progress of fashion much faster. Mm. So when we start with these characters at the beginning of the show, they feel like they are very much in 1947, yeah. and then they jump forward into like visually at the end of the show, it's much more early 50s sort of vibe to things.
I know I cannot wait to see it again because mm-hmm. I think it's such an important story to be telling because it deals mostly with post-traumatic stress disorder, which is something we don't really talk about, one in the theater and two specifically musical theater. So I'm very excited that's going to be exposed to a whole mm-hmm. new audience and there'll be a whole new topic of conversation that emerges out of it.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I love about the show is it's a little bit of a honey trap in that I think that there is a certain audience that understands World War II stories as something that is, it's about like the heroes band together and in this case, we're watching this group of veterans come together to form a band to win a contest. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I feel like I've seen this, wartime yeah. movie.
Yeah.
My grandfather actually was in the Navy. He was a Navy pilot.
Oh, yeah.
In World War II and then for much of his life after the war. And he was also a musician, and as was his twin brother, who was also in the Navy. So there's a great picture I keep with my research of them. They were featured in Life magazine.
Wow.
His battalion was on leave. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, what are these, airmen on leave? And it's him with his Italian mother sitting around, like, playing piano and trumpet. And so this, band of army vets is very close to me. And then also I know, like, this, I've always seen these joyous pictures of my grandfather up on the walls growing up. But also I didn't read the actual article that went out. Like, I went and found that Life magazine when I was in college. And I didn't even know, and he talks about being shot down, and he was in the water for over a day, waiting to get picked up. But he never talked about that, and sort of understanding that, like, he just never talked about the war. And so that was a real sort of way in emotionally. So we have this show where it's like, oh, it's so happy. Like, I think of that Life magazine photo. And then the sort of gut punch is like, oh, no, actually, this is about PTSD.
Deep down, yeah.
It's a really beautiful show, and your work on it is so phenomenal. Because there are so many characters, and they're all part of this band. And so they're all uniformed in some way, shape, or form. And to keep track of everybody and their emotional journey, it's a tough job, and you do it so well. So congratulations on that. Can't wait to see that.
We're putting it all together right now. It's very different than Great Comet.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more cinematic. It's much more like you really want the clothes to disappear.
Yeah.
They're part of the storytelling, but it should seem like you got transported back to the 40s mm-hmm. and are just walking down the street, which is actually a really hard trick to pull
sure,
off.
Sure, sure. So subtle, yeah. Indeed.
Yeah. Paloma, thank you so much for joining us today. And so once again, you can go see Paloma's work on Natasha Pierre and The Great Comet of 1812.
And The Bandstand.
And then Bandstand.
Bandstand, not The Bandstand.
Love it. Bandstand.
Thank you so much, guys.
Coming up pretty soon.
Thank you so much, Paloma.
Bye-bye.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens. Bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens. Brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things.
I dreamed a dream of days to come, where sponsorship is high and money is forthcoming.
That's beautiful, Kevin.
No, I really added a voice onto that one, too. I really was trying to go for something there.
Listeners, we love creating this podcast, but it does cost money. Please don't make me sell my Angel record.
Oh my gosh, the original cast recording of Angel.
That, like, nobody has.
Nobody has it.
If you like what we are doing and want us to keep doing more of it, please head over to patreon.com.
What?
That's patreon.com.
Patreon.
Patreon.
Yeah,
Patreon.
Rion.
Patreon.
Yeah, and once you're there, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. And of course, we don't expect to give without receiving some great rewards.
Such rewards include behind-the-scenes videos, shout-outs on future episodes, or episodes, depending on what part of the country you're from, because I said episodes, and early access to some of our podcasts. Hell, for the right price, Kevin and I will come to your apartment and act out all of Agnes of God.
So head over, friends, to patreon.com to help us out.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.